Blog Talk Radio.
Veteran investigation experts, along with noted crime consultants and attorneys often featured on the popular news programs for families of violent crime to find answers and seek justice. The Crime Wire team, Vito Colucci Jr., private investigator and author, Denny Griffin, retired investigator and author, Tom Shamshak, former police chief, private investigator and instructor at Boston University, and Susan Murphy Milano, violence expert and author, are there on top of the crime at the top of their game. Crime Wire is the place for information, news, safety, and most importantly, justice. Our interactive website is www.crimewiresite.com. You can call in anytime during the show. The number is 646-478-0982. And remember, you can participate in tonight's show simply by going to the live interactive chat room here on Blog Talk Radio. If you are a friend or family member and would like to send the Crime Wire team information about an unsolved or suspicious death case, or want to be considered for a segment on a case for a future show, email us at thecrimewire@gmail.com. Susan and Denny have the night off. During the summer, Crime Wire discussed the suspicious death of Selena Cass, an 11-year-old girl living in northern New Hampshire. Tonight we're going to go over that case again. There have been some updates. Little Selena went missing from her home last July 25th. The following day, police launched an intense search that involved more than 100 local, state, and federal law enforcement authorities. Sadly, the search ended on August 1st when police divers discovered Selena's body in a river close to a hydroelectric dam about a quarter of a mile from her home. The young girl's body was wrapped in bedding. An autopsy was performed, however, the medical examiner was unable to determine the manner and cause of death. Earlier this month, police announced that the results of toxicology tests indicate that Selena was the victim of a homicide. Police will not say what caused the girl's death, and no suspects have been named. A reward has been offered for information leading to an arrest. Some lingering questions. Who murdered Selena? And secondly, why are police having trouble cracking this case? Joining us tonight to discuss this mystery are Crime Wire consultants Dean and Karen Beers, the husband and wife team who own and operate the highly regarded firm Associates in Forensic Investigations, LLC, based in Colorado. Before we get to Dean and Karen, just a little recap here. The case was discussed here on Crime Wire, and at the time we knew that stepfather's automobile and an automobile owned by another young man living in that two-family home had been impounded and searched, but thus far no results. And it's a perplexing matter, because here we have an 11-year-old who was in her home, vanishes, and apparently the girl's mother now is disputing some information that has been brought to light by the stepfather, who claimed that he was not at home, but he was away from the residence. The mother now is saying that the stepfather indeed was at home, was there on the porch drinking that night while this young 11-year-old had been last seen at her computer in the evening hours. Vito, your thoughts on it?
Yeah, a couple things, Tom. Number one, you know, is the stepfather still married to the mom here, or are they headed to a breakup because of this, especially if she's going against him and telling the truth, so to speak? That shouldn't last very long on that part. I mean, the police are playing it close to the vest, like you know, Tom, and the Beers, I mean, all of our backgrounds here. You know, was there a part of a sexual assault on this girl? We don't know yet. They're not going to tell us that, okay? How was she killed? They only know that. We don't know it, you know, what type of way. The bottom line, though, you can bet your bottom dollar that they are going to look, you know, and continue to look very heavily at the stepfather and maybe this other man that's in the house. You know, because, you know, those are the first ones, as you know, and as we hear all the time on the shows from the Talking Heads, that those are the ones that not only are looked at first, but in most cases, Tom, are involved in this. So it's going to be interesting. As far as your question there, and I'll turn it back to you, as far as your question, why are the police having trouble cracking this case? I think you, me, and the Beers know more than maybe a lot of our listeners how long it takes many times to crack a case. Now, to the family, their child being missing from July 25th, sounds like an eternity, and it would to any of us with our own children, brother or sisters or whatever. But, you know, they have a one-shot deal. They can't arrest the wrong person, lose a conviction on that individual, or arrest the right person and still lose it by not putting the case together properly. So I think it's going to be a wait and see on this.
Hi, let me get back to something you raised earlier. Indeed, the mother and the stepfather are separated, and it appears that you know, divorce proceedings are in the offing here. And you know, I suspect that the mother may you know, turn and hopefully will provide more information that will help crack this case. But right now, it appears that this is a CSI case in the offing, and let me bring in Dean and Karen on this. Dean and Karen, good evening.
Hello.
Karen.
Good evening, Tom.
Hi, guys. Well,
how are you?
All right, I'm fine. Vito and I welcome you, and our listeners welcome you. You know, we're going to you know, seek your input regarding the forensics on this. Now, you know, last time we chatted about this case, you had offered some, you know, perspective on the forensics, you know, about the condition of a body that was immersed in water for a number of days, that there would be some obvious forensic challenges there. Now that we know that there are toxicology results back that have you know, been determined that this is a homicide, give us some insight. Give the listeners across the country some insight into what law enforcement may have analyzed and come up with.
Well, since they have mentioned the toxicology, and they said that it is a homicide, then the child was probably... obviously, the toxicology is to the point that a major, probably overdose of some kind of drug. It could be, honestly, it could be anything. It could be the date rape drug. Anything's possible.
Alcohol?
Well, alcohol.
Yeah.
Alcohol, sedatives. We'll be talking about another case for sedatives. You know, any of the opioids and narcotics, and a cocktail of stuff. My first thought is that the body being near the family home, you know, that's a convenient, quick dump spot from the abduction site, and it could also indicate that the suspect is in that area. But it also could be, to go back to toxicology, you know, a cocktail of stuff, but probably something was used to incapacitate her, and overdosed on that. It's, you know, at 11 years old, it's not likely that she was seduced away by having a, you know, some kind of drug induced relationship with somebody. So there's several points of toxicology that can be made. The other point to consider is that the condition of the body has been somewhat released, in that it wasn't viewable. It was also therefore at autopsy determined that there wasn't any physical trauma either noted or able to be determined. So again, toxicology being one of the primary issues.
Okay, so the police have said they know what caused the death. However, they're not revealing that. What do you make of that?
One of the first things that comes to my mind on that is, of course, they've identified the drug and the quantity of the drug, probably from muscle tissue or something like that. And now they're needing to probably check computers of any suspects, even though they haven't named any or at least persons of interest, to see if they've researched those drugs, how to manufacture them, where to buy them, or if they've even had their own prescriptions for any of those drugs or able to buy those or have a history of even arrests in illegally purchasing prescription drugs. So those would be some of the things that I think law enforcement will be looking at.
Well, that's a good perspective there. So they would look to see if any of the parties involved may have had legal prescriptions
or even a history of criminal activity where they've been, say, arrested for dealing in the prescriptions or purchasing the prescriptions, prescription kiting, prescription mill relationships, things like that. I don't think New Hampshire is as big on pill mills as say, down in Florida. But there's certainly those things that they need to look into.
Okay. Vito, do you have any experience with these kinds of cases?
Yeah, Tom, just listening to Dee makes a lot of great points there. What you see on this case, Tom, is this case is going to be solved by a marriage of new forensics and old-fashioned police work. The stuff that Dean says, that you're going to check on the pills, you're going to check on every single computer, you bring it to the forensic lab, download this, cell phone records, all stuff like that. But meanwhile, if I'm working this case, if I'm in charge of this case, both as a cop or a private detective, I love to sit across the table with the mom, with the stepfather, with anybody else that knows the stepfather. If he hangs out at Joe's Bar and Grill, I want to talk to all the people over there. I want to see the relationship with him and this girl, his stepdaughter. I want to find out all those kind of things. And like Tom, as you're interviewing people and then a week later you say, hey, come on back in again. I just got a couple more questions. And you catch them in that one lie, that one discrepancy, or you interview them three times and you've got three different stories. Right away you're going to take a different look at him. So I think this is going to be a combination of a lot of things on this, and like I like to say a lot of times, the marriage of old work, old-fashioned police work, and a lot of the new technology, because I like to sit across the table and see the characteristics when a hand goes up to the mouth, when somebody gets nervous, they start tapping their foot, all kinds of different things of that nature, just to kind of get a gauge in your own mind, Tom,
Yeah. Well, the...
I think we had a question on the blog here, Tom.
Yeah, and there was a question from Grace, and what's the percentage that family is involved in abductions or missing child cases? And, I responded here that parental custodial abductions are indeed a significant problem, there are a couple thousand cases a year of parents taking their children, but here this was my take on it is that there may have been some type of a sexual offense committed on this child, and she was killed to prevent any identification of the perpetrator. That's my take. Vito?
Yeah, that's a good point. That's a very good point. What do you think on that, Dean? Or Karen?
Excuse me. I agree with Tom completely on that. Karen had some thoughts earlier when we were talking about this with the interesting turn of information about the stepfather, having probably been social drinking that night. According to some news reports. So that's certainly of interest related to Tom's question. Could alcohol have been a factor in her death? And of course it could have been. She would be consuming the alcohol versus, possibly being ingested with something or even chloroform or something like that inhaled. type of thing.
And not only that,
it seems
Tom,
to me like it was a hurried way to get rid of the body, with it being that close to the residence, and they didn't even, you know, take the time to try to cover it up. You know, they didn't bury her. They put her in the water.
That's a good point, because criminals on a hurried thing like that, Karen, they don't have a floor plan. They don't have a 101 manual in front of them. It's kind of like a panic situation. I got to do something quick, and you just kind of do whatever first comes to mind, you know, rather than somebody pulling off a bank robbery. Maybe with a bank robbery, they study, they see where the armored cars come, things of that nature. But people in situations like this, this is when they just do whatever comes to mind real quick, because they don't have a lot of time to. And you know, Tom and everybody, nothing wrong with even getting a reaction from all of these people here when you look them in the eye and say, hey, why don't we do a polygraph so we can eliminate you? I always love to do that, to see the eye expressions and everything else, that the nervousness some of them may get or things like that. Nothing wrong at all to continue using that kind of a policy over the years, too, on cases like this, you know?
Dean and Karen, here's a question. If the child was the victim of a sexual assault, would the fact that she had been immersed for at least a week in water, would that have in any way compromised the ability of forensic investigators to obtain, you know, semen from the body?
Well, it could, basically, depending on, you know, if the animals, you know, if they were a fish or whatever, were chewing on her, that can cause a lot of problems on getting or seeing for the sexually assault. It just depends. There's just so much, especially when a body's been submerged in water. There's so many different factors. But if they can, you sometimes can get, if part of her body was preserved under a rock or something, then they may be able to get, obviously they got something from tissue. So she was preserved well enough to get that kind of information.
Hey, Karen and Dean, how about this this question? How bruising, okay? Let's just say again, like Tom brought up, there was a sexual assault here, okay? Bruising of her private area as a young child, an 11-year-old, do you think you'd still be able to see that if somebody tried to penetrate or touch or do something like that? Would you still be able to determine that a week or so later?
It would be a little bit difficult, especially with the body submersed in water, but you know, as Karen pointed out, it does kind of depend on if there was any protection, such as, if I recall correctly, she had a motorcycle passenger that was submerged for several weeks, but it was also partially protected by a boulder, and that part of the body was as well as, you know, riding chaps, leather chaps, so that part of the body was fairly well preserved, but the exposed portions to the current were not. So it could, and my guess is if they haven't commented on that, it's probably undetermined at best if there were what may have been involved in a physical or sexual assault. The other thing to touch base on regarding the sexual assault is, A, if a person were by chance wearing a condom, and the other is even if not, and if there was a semen in the vaginal vault, will last, you know, 7 to 10 days just in normal conditions. So, you know, and I know it was pretty close to that period of time that she was recovered, so that would certainly play a factor on top of the being exposed to the water and possibly contaminating the vaginal, any areas that were assaulted, if they were, but it's likely, honestly, in these cases, as we know, you know, it's an abduction isn't just a case of an abduction. There's a reason for the abduction, and predominantly in these types of cases, you know, Vito and Tom knows better than I do, sexual assault is usually the purpose.
Yeah, I mean, basically, what are you going to do with an 11-year-old unless some sickie, whether it's the stepfather or somebody else. And Tom, we don't know, and we won't know how fully clothed she was when she was found.
True. All that has been released is that she was in some type of bedding and wrapped up. And that's, you know, again, I recall days before we featured this case in August, the news accounts were saying that it was a suspicious death. And, you know, and it was like, okay, so we commented, what would be suspicious, that she was in a sleeping bag or a knapsack or some type of, a wrapping. And then later we learned it was leaked that she had been wrapped in some type of bedding. And I presume that's either a sheet or a blanket that came from her home. So it comes right back to, the original crime scene was probably there at the house. And yet police have still not been able to come up with any hard physical evidence or testimonial evidence, and for that matter, documentary evidence, in terms of if there was anybody in the home that had a history of legal prescriptions or a history of criminal involvement with drugs. It's a real interesting dilemma here. I can understand the mother's frustration at the lack of progress in this case.
Yeah, I mean, it's a shame. It has been going on for a while, and families just want to call you every day. If you're the PI or if you're the lead investigator or whoever, they just want to hear something from you. It even makes them feel closer if they're able to call you and say, Chief Tom, anything new on my daughter's case? Anything at all? Well, we're doing this. I think we got something scheduled for Saturday. We're going to go to this lake nearby. And at least it's something for a parent, for a loved one. I mean, we've been on the other side of this, thank God, and we work these cases. And you try, and I think I'm much better now than I was as a cop, being younger and just kind of having a little more of a brash attitude, I would say, back then, that I'm not too proud of. But you have to learn to deal with the public in a right way. You know, guys, all of us?
Mm-hmm. True.
Exactly. One of the things that we, Karen and I, were talking about earlier in reviewing this case was that the mother had not been allowed to see the blanket that she was found in. And that's an interesting piece of information. It kind of indicates to me that she's not noticing anything specific missing or was able to pinpoint something. And yet, of course, as we know, they're going to keep that information to themselves, as information that only the perpetrator might know about. And the other is, we haven't seen any reports of if there was any evidence of binding, whether that be, like, for example, tape or rope or, something around the hands, or even if it had, fell off during in water currents, if there's indications on the wrist, it would probably, if it was like for a rope or something, it would probably be much easier to tell if there was that type of binding. So I'd be curious if she was bound, taped, such as, the Kaylee Anthony situation, or if she were just wrapped in the blanket, which, and 11 years old isn't big, but it's not small either. So that takes some effort to dispose of that body unseen.
Yeah, the news accounts suggest that she was in wearing pajamas. And
okay.
So we can assume that, again, she had been last seen by the stepfather at her computer that night, somewhere between 8 and 10. And, that would be normal behavior for, a child of that age. And, it suggests that somebody there in that home, again, this is not, the stepfather says, oh, it was an intruder. I don't buy that. And we're hearing that now in this contemporary case with the missing
baby, the Lisa,
10-month-old.
Right.
The Lisa Irwin case, where, oh, an intruder came in. I don't buy that at all.
And now you're hearing that the mother says she was drinking that night. She threw that into the mix now.
Yeah,
and again, here we've got the mother of Selena Cass saying that the stepfather and a couple of friends were socializing on the front porch of the home the night of Selena's disappearance. And it's mind-boggling that, there are these individuals, and they've been strip-searched, I'm told, from, you know, the media, and that they have undergone polygraphs, and yet there's no justice here on the table.
Yeah, what's good about them two having a rift now, the mother and the stepfather, is that the mother can be a wealth of information to you as an investigator, even on the point of how long have you been married? How was his relationship with your daughter? Did he like her? Did he not like her? Was he overly friendly? Was he hugging her all the time, kissing her, or he just had disdain for her? I mean, there's all different kinds of points. Go on, Karen. I'm sorry to interrupt you.
Well, I just, you know, it's also interesting that you're dealing with this stepfather who's supposedly a schizophrenic and has been in and out of mental hospitals. And so you're dealing with someone that already has some issues and not knowing if he's on medication, not on medication, and finding the truth from somebody like that is going to be more difficult.
Yeah, and somebody like that can very easily pass a polygraph because when
absolutely.
They're saying it, they think it's the truth what they're
saying. They think they believe it, absolutely.
Right, right.
Well, I don't know where we go from here with this. I think it's a matter of sitting
great
back.
Case to follow, Tom. It's keep us all informed too on that. You know, whatever you hear on it as well, because it's not highlighted too much on
no.
a lot of the cable shows at all. So.
This case hasn't been, you know, front and center like so many cases have been. But I will have to give them credit for keeping so much information to themselves, you know, the detectives and keeping it out of the media. It's been good. It'll be better for their investigation, but I do think, you know, the case definitely deserves a lot more than what it's gotten nationwide.
And again, it has to be somebody that was there, you know, sometime during the evening. I mean, it was not an intruder. That's for sure.
No.
No, not an intruder. And without knowing what the prescriptions the stepfather was taking, I can tell you from history of death cases that, persons have committed suicide on medicines used for schizophrenia. So it would not be, you know, out of the question for the toxicology results to possibly include, a prescription that he would have been using for his schizophrenia, as an example.
Yeah, I mean, the stuff, I've had a close relative who has died, but a very, very close relative that was on these type of medications for many years, and you get stuff like Haldol, which is a powerful, powerful medicine or medicines like that. So it's like Karen said, it's very tough because even if and when you try to nail the subject, he may not go away to jail. He may go to a hospital for X amount of years or whatever it may be.
Right.
So we'll have this is one of those stay tuned cases, you know?
Right.
How about we just kind of segue? You mentioned Haldol. That's a very powerful drug. Let me ask Dean and Karen, have you had any experience with, like the drug propofol, which we're going to talk about in our next segment?
I haven't.
I have been trying to think of the cases I've had, and I have to say no, with the exception of persons that have been hospitalized, possibly on a ventilator or something like that, having it found in their toxicology, which would be expected. But as far as an unattended death, even though the next case, you know, the physician was theoretically in attendance, I can't recall that I have, no. But drugs similar effects and similar use, yeah, probably.
All right. Well, why don't we kind of move on to the next case. And, Dean and Karen, can you guys hang around for a bit with us?
Oh, sure.
Sure we can.
Very good.
Well, let me turn it over to Vito.
Okay. Dr. Conrad Murray one of the biggest cases in the country, if not the biggest right now, is on trial for the crime of involuntary manslaughter in the death of pop icon Michael Jackson. Michael died in his own bed at home. He died as a result of being given the drug propofol, a powerful anesthetic that is intended for hospital use only. Dr. Murray was hired as a doctor by Jackson to attend to his medical needs for $150,000 a month. Dr. Murray says he was out of Michael's bedroom for only a short time to go to the bathroom, during which time he alleges Jackson self-administered the lethal dose of propofol. Cell phone records are expected to show that Dr. Murray was out of the bedroom for a longer period of time, talking on the phone to his girlfriend. When Dr. Murray discovered that Jackson was non-responsive, Murray did not call 911. Instead, he called Jackson's assistant. Why was there a delay in calling for an ambulance? Was evidence of a crime being removed from the scene? Did Murray tell arriving paramedics that Jackson had propofol in his body? Guys, interesting case. I've done a couple of shows on this. I did most recently Joy Behar a couple days ago, and she asked me, I was on with Mark Garagos, and she asked me the hard questions on this, why he had so many other pills, so many, the amounts of all these pills that he had. And I explained to her, I said, I live in Fairfield County, Connecticut, which is rated the richest county in the entire country, if not the richest, the second or the third, which encompasses Greenwich, Connecticut, Darien, Connecticut. Many rich people live there. They do not have the same rules that all the other people have. I've done cases against doctors in my county where discovery was turned over to us. And I've actually sat at the table with the lawyers and the other investigators and found 400 of this pill, 600 of that pills found on the person, 300 of this. And people may wonder, well, how the heck could they get that much? There's only supposed to be 50 pills in that prescription. It doesn't matter because the doctor will go. We had many envelopes of pills that were sent to the subject on my case that were coming from Texas, Fort Worth, Texas, all many different places across the country with different names, P.O. boxes, same address or whatever. So that's what happens, Tom, as you know, on a lot of cases of this nature. They're allowed to get whatever they want. And this man getting $150,000 a month, not a year, $150,000 a month, is going to take care of his client and give him whatever he wants, basically, you know?
Sure, because if he didn't do it, he'd be gone, and Jackson
they'll find somebody else that will do it.
Yeah, that would be willing to do that, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's amazing. Now, propofol, I watched, before I did a couple of these shows, I saw a little bit of a highlight on CNN where one of their doctors, who's a regular on the show, I think Dr. Gupta, actually went into an operating room, and he showed the listeners how this drug, with another doctor that's giving it to one of the patients that was going to be operated on, the powerfulness of this drug, how it's administered, and the anesthesiologist has to constantly watch the person because it will knock the person out. The heartbeat could slow down and even almost look like it's going to stop. They have to be brought back. I mean, it's a very powerful drug that is not, you know, some people may say, well, yeah, some people are allowed to get it out of the hospital. No, that's a lot of baloney. Any doctor you talk to is going to tell you this is a powerful drug. To have it in the house under certain conditions is not going to work. And that's what this man was on. You know, it was a lot of this stuff. It's absolutely horrible.
Dean and Karen, have you been involved in any kind of investigation resembling, you know, the fact pattern here with Dr. Conrad Murray?
On a smaller scale, you know, here in the area that we live in, to a smaller scale, that propofol, for one, you know, it's used, for example, for patients on ventilators and in ORs because of the powerfulness of it. I mean, it's specifically, you know, designed to keep you under sedated with a low dosage. It's relatively inexpensive compared to some of the others. It's replaced historically some other drugs because when a person comes out of it, they have a clearer mind, which is probably why people abusing it, such as Michael Jackson, could do that. But this is, from what I've been researching, it's a drug of, it's going to be a drug of the rich, simply because you can't get a hold of it, and it's going to be very expensive. You know, this comes to mind, the Anna Nicole Smith situation, which wasn't, even though it was a different drug, it was a similar situation, and the forensic toxicologist that we consult with was actually involved in that case. And so we talked to him a little bit about that case and a few others. And, you know, this fact pattern is especially when you have a treating physician that's willing to, you know, obtain these drugs, you know, from other locations. I mean, they sign the prescription and get them shipped from somewhere, or they just know the black market path, which is usually the case from the experience I've had. You know, they'll use the black market to get the drug shipped, such as what Howard Stern was charged with, among other things. So it's going to be a complicated case to prove the circumstances for that involuntary manslaughter. I haven't seen, you know, the specific evidence, but it's going to be difficult. But what I've seen so far, it indicates, you know, he had knowledge, you know, of what was going on. He certainly had knowledge of its illicit use. And the interesting thing is that, you know, when he's not calling for help, what was going on in that short period of time, or possibly extended period of time, depending on what the cell phone records show.
Good point, Gene.
If you were brought in on the law enforcement side of this, what would you what would you be looking for, you know, during that delay period? What would you hypothesize was going on?
Well, determine the amount of time, and then what movement could have been completed, you know, in the Jackson home during that time, and where could things have been secreted and moved, so that when somebody makes their first initial search, because coroners and medical examiners have a right to search the area around the decedent to search for identification and any contributing evidence to the cause of death without a search warrant. However, when it comes to a homicide, most of them will, you know, because of the legal concerns, will get the search warrant. But they could have initially been looking for things, as well as paramedics, you know, what was in plain view sight, and where could they have easily hidden it. That would have been one of the first things I would have wanted to know, is where could things have been secreted in that amount of time. I also would have, you know, were other phone calls made, which is, you know, hopefully revealed on the cell phone records, you know, things like that.
Would they have been able to determine, you know, through – you know, perhaps body temperature, how long Jackson had been non-responsive?
That would be difficult because drugs will affect body temperature. Body temperature is roughly cooling at 1.5 degrees per hour. In ambient room temperature of, I believe it's about 75 degrees, with, you know, on studies of males that weighed about 175 pounds. So that's not the most reliable way to go. And when you induce drugs, such as some of the date rape drugs, increase body temperature, and then others. So if we have a false preservation of body temperature, we may not be able to accurately determine the time of death. So other circumstances would need to be looked into. That time frame, if he was making cell phone calls, is going to be pretty indicative. But you can also, a forensic toxicologist, that is, can take the lifespan and the half-life of propofol, for example, and the amount that was determined to be in his body, and work backwards and possibly determine a time frame of death.
Let's say it's 7 o'clock at night. Jackson says, "I want to go to sleep." Help us here with this. So the doctor administers an injection. Like, how many cc's would be injected, hypothetically, and how long would that last? And then the doctor has to do what? Another one at 11 o'clock at night, and then another one at 3 o'clock in the morning. Tell us about that.
Yeah, and I don't have the specifics in our area. It's difficult with toxicology because of the intricacies, but there is going to be a developed regimen involved that he's experienced and used with Michael Jackson over a period of time. I mean, you know, Michael Jackson was given this milk of amnesia, as they call it, you know, because it's milky substance, and it's used, you know, for anesthesia. But he would have determined the best course of both dosage and time frame to keep the effect going. If Michael Jackson wanted to stay asleep for 4 hours or 8 hours or 12 hours, you know, he would have figured out how long it would take, what the dosage would be. Now, if Michael Jackson did inject himself, which isn't out of the question, you know, he could have certainly overdosed himself, and the involuntary manslaughter is going to be where there was a controlled substance that, well, basically wasn't under control. So the specifics are, you know, would need to be looked into, and I'm sure they're going to have, you know, both sides, their own forensic toxicologists involved to show, you know, how long it had to have been or how long it could not have been or what the dosages would have had to have been. But it's not going to be a simple thing. I mean, you know, obviously some math and some knowledge of what was available and what dosage and what strength the propofol was are all going to be important.
All right.
Go ahead, Vito. Now, what I was going to say, I want our listeners to understand here, because why did Murray not call 911? Now, we did touch on it a little bit, but you see, what happens here is that if it's another person in the room, if a doctor's not in that room and it's a relative or a friend, they can maybe buy out of this by saying, oh, my God, I panicked. I just yelled for somebody in the other room. I ran downstairs, blah, blah, blah. This is a doctor. You know, there's the jury is going to turn this guy off if he tries to get out of this part of it about not calling 911. Now, if this is true and if this man is involved, you have to understand his mindset. Jackson dies in front of you. Okay, now he knows the job is over, the $150K a month job is over, but now he has to think about not going to jail or not losing his license, not being out of the medical. All these things quickly are going through his head. So what he has to do in that quick time is try to get rid of, hide, do whatever with anything in that room that's going to incriminate him. And that's his mindset. I mean, there's absolutely no reason why a doctor who's under pressure all the time on cases that he does would not think about calling 911. So, I mean, there's no way he can get out of that part of it, Tom.
So the doctor was supposed to be awake all night, overnight, monitoring Jackson's vital signs. Is that a fair assessment, Dean?
Absolutely, and that was one of the things I was going to mention, is that in the operating room or even, you know.
Yep. We lose him? Tom?
Yeah, Dean, you there? No.
Hello?
Oh, Karen's still there, right?
I'm here.
There you go.
Are we here?
Yeah, we can hear you.
I can hear Dean.
Okay. I don't know where I was suddenly cut off at, but one of the things I was going to mention is, you know, this is a controlled environment that this drug is used for, along with, you know, any other drugs used in the operating room for anesthesia. And he would have likely had some of those drugs available for resuscitation or, so to speak, balancing out, you know, any heart arrhythmias or anything that would have come along, you know, keeping track of blood pressure, stuff like that. So, If that equipment hasn't been reported as having been found, and I'm curious if it was there. And the other thing to keep in mind, to go back to Tom's question about time of death, is these drugs are used intravenously. So there would have been, you know, a regulated drip, which, you know, and the bag is, you know, there's going to be a certain dosage in the bag. And you could calculate at least how long that drip's been taking place to go, you know, and go back to how long he'd been administered that particular dosage of drug.
Is it plausible that Jackson could have, as the defense early on asserted, injected himself and caused the overdose? Is that reasonable?
Well, anything's possible. Not knowing really now whether the man really was stepped out of the room for any length of time. This is just, you know, his word against somebody that's no longer with us. But it's possible. And the other thing is with drug use, and obviously he had been using this for quite a few years, your tolerance, you know, you want more because the old dose doesn't work. You know, it's just like any kind of medication that, and well, let's face it, he was an addict. So whether he could have gotten the stuff himself, I mean, anything's possible. But, you know, I wouldn't think there would be any reason other than maybe he felt like the dose, it wasn't taking hold or something like that. But as I don't think there's any indication that this would have been a suicide at all.
What organs would they look at to determine, you know, if he took it, you know, orally, if he swallowed it, would there be traces of that in the esophagus and in his you know, throat?
There could be. Typically, at autopsy, unless there's a reason to believe that would have been a method of delivery, they're usually not scraped, you know, swabbed and sent in for testing. I'm not sure what organ disposes of the drug. For example, you know, the kidney or the liver, you know, the filtering process through the blood system. But that would have been one of the organs that they would have looked at. So, for example, liver, kidneys, and I'm sorry, I'm just not familiar with which organ. For example, Tylenol is more, you know, passes through, you know, one component, whereas ibuprofen will pass through another, and that's why you can take a little bit of one but and the other without worrying too much about overdosing. The other concern I had with this situation is, you know, I'm really not following that Michael Jackson would have self-administered, as the doctor's been saying. And the reason I say that is, you know, realizing that, you know, the report is that he was already administered some of this drug. And the doctor, if he's supposed to make sure that Michael Jackson stays under for a period of time, isn't going to let him come out of the drug. He's going to make sure he stays under it. So that's also where the involuntary manslaughter, I think, is coming from, is the fact that Michael Jackson probably had no reason, there's no reason to indicate that he would have self-administered. Therefore, somebody else did. And he was also under physician's care.
And he paid a lot of money for that physician's care. And he trusted him, you know. And that's it's a shame.
Hey, Tom.
Yes.
What I think what's going to happen on this, and this is just one man's opinion on the final result of this, if jurors listen very carefully to the judge's orders to them at the end of the trial, okay, what he says to them, they could come away with a not guilty verdict, only because what we have here is you have circumstantial evidence, a preponderance maybe of circumstantial evidence. But, you know, you don't have – see, a juror, you could read about a juror the next day in a paper saying, do I think maybe the doctor did it? I think he really screwed up, and I hope he loses his license and never practices again. But I just could not – put my finger on it to say he did this, this, and that to kill him. You see, and I think that's what's going to happen on this case here, because you still are not able. Do I believe he should be charged guilty? Sure, I believe that. But is there going to be enough there to do it on this case? So when he charges the jury and he says different things to the jury, it's going to depend a lot about that, because, you know, that's going to be a big determining factor. Because if he sends the people into the back room saying, did you hear what the judge said? I haven't seen that on this case. I haven't got to that point where I could do it. You know, I mean, I think he's through as a doctor, obviously, and a lot of stuff in civil suits maybe and everything else. So he's done. Okay, but will he be charged? Will he be convicted on this? I don't know. I hope he is, because I've seen these cases. I've worked against doctors on these cases with big, big celebrities and different people. But I don't know if there's enough there, Tom, for to get a guilty verdict.
Yeah, you're right about, I mean, if he is fortunate to avoid a conviction, I think the medical board in California will summarily seek his license. But again, even if they didn't do that, would you or anybody in their right mind ever retain him as a physician?
Oh, of course not. And I don't know if it's been brought out in the trial. You guys would probably know more than me on it. I think it has been. And this shouldn't be in consideration. The judge is going to say, don't bring that into consideration, but jurors do. All right, the guy has had three or four girlfriends. He has a baby with one of the girls. He's still married. Okay, so a lot of the women in juries that I have seen in the high-profile cases, Jason Williams, Skakel, whatever ones of that nature, that you see on their face when I've sat front row, you see them actually have this disdained look on their face. I've seen people actually turn almost a little bit sideways, and they don't even want to hear anything more. So, you know, it depends, but the can they get a guilty conviction even though they don't like the guy and like and feel that he did it? Give me the proof. Okay, we can yell and scream all about the last case a couple months ago with the not guilty verdict. But, you know, the jurors have said it wasn't proven to them, and they tried to follow the letter of the law. So, I mean, you know.
Well, it's not a perfect system. It does have its flaws, and you know, each jury has its own dynamics, and so, you know, it's a roll of the dice.
This is a case you cannot call. You cannot call this case. I just gave you one person's opinion. But if anybody tells you this is good, what's going to happen for sure, or that's going to happen for sure, this is a roll of the dice with the jury. This is totally a jury's, a big thing on the jury on this one.
I agree.
It's definitely a jury call, but you know, his intent, I don't know if the, like you said, you know, the instructions that the judge gives, I'm sure the man didn't intend. It was definitely neglect. You know, he, again, money is the big role here, you know, on both sides.
You don't want to lose, you don't want your patient to die on you when you're making that. You don't
absolutely
want your patient
not
to die ever, but you don't want your
that
patient to die at $150,000 a month, Karen, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And there's always the civil wrongful death suit.
Yep.
Yeah.
Well, I think that'll be easier to prove.
Right.
Mere preponderance of the evidence that if he was out of the room, you know, making telephone calls and not being attentive, I mean, he's got an unusual role here. I mean, he was, you know, an overnight supervisor, if you will, and he was alone. I gather he didn't even have a nurse or any type of medical assistant there, you know, in is that substandard care? Obviously, I mean, but if this stuff was never intended to be used outside a hospital setting, you know, I think that's a, you know, pretty clear and demonstrative hurdle that, you know, the defense is going to have to get over.
Right.
It won't come up in the criminal venue, but it will come up in the civil venue. For example, the Anna Nicole Smith, where Howard Stern, you know, was alleged to have, you know, acquired and given the prescription drugs. And this, you know, he was a lay person. He wasn't a trained medical doctor or in the medical profession. In the civil case, he's going to be expected to have performed the higher standard. And that's going to make it very difficult for him in the civil case to overcome. Even all other things aside, like Karen mentioned, you know, a few of those points that lay responsibility towards him. In a criminal case, maybe, you know, it's involuntary, so they're not trying to prove intent, but at the same time, they are proving his culpability, but they'll have a much easier time in the civil case, especially when he has to demonstrate, you know, due to his, you know, being a medical doctor, that there was a certain expectation of a level of care and supervisory. And he didn't have a nurse on staff because, well, less witnesses, in my opinion.
Well, it's an interesting case. I believe he'll be found guilty, and largely because the one.
I hope you're right.
That should propofol have ever been administered in a setting other than a controlled hospital environment.
Hospital,
and if the answer
right
to that is, you know, no, it never should have, then, I mean, I can't see. I don't know how the jury gets around, I just don't see that. I think it's a, you know, pretty straightforward case. But, again, that we've seen, a couple months ago, we thought the jurors were going to come back. It was a slam dunk, and that wasn't the case.
No, it was a slam, all right, but
yep.
That was a slam. Yeah, and on another note on that too, along with that Tom's comment, you know, and not being in the facility. You know, there are, I don't know what the doctor is charged with criminally, but there are charges associated to, you know, disseminating those drugs, you know, regardless if he had a prescription, but not in the right protocol. And hopefully if that's one of the charges, at the very least they could find some guilt in that if they don't step up and find guilt, you know, of involuntary manslaughter. But, you know, I guess we'll have to see.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. There are plenty of cases out there, and, you know, there's no shortage of material for us to discuss here on CrimeWire.
No, I mean, just, you know, in our last couple minutes, I mean, we had that Selena Cass case, first of all, the top of the hour, for half an hour, and, you know, we talked about it, how we're not seeing it featured. But, you know, it's a shame, and there's no other way you could do it. There's thousands of Selena Cass's cases
yep.
across the country. You know, we had Kaylee Anthony. You know, I mean, I do these shows weekly, okay, and they're fine. They're good for what they do. But once they get hooked up with one case and it grabs the public's attention and they have huge ratings from it, they're going to follow that case all the way to the end. And it's a shame, because if I'm the mother or father of another child that's killed in a very horrible way too, and I'm trying to get through to a channel or what one of these other shows, and it's a shame because there's thousands of these same cases that are going on out there. And, you know, unless you really had a 24-hour-a-day cable channel that is just concentrating on these cases and had talk shows from morning to night and repeating them from maybe midnight to 8, there's no other way you're going to feature dozens and dozens of these cases, you know?
Right.
That's why I like what we do here. We have, you know, Dean and Karen on, Tom, you know, Denny and Susan, and we take a lot of times, we take these cases that are not what they call high profile. And like I always said, a high profile case is high profile to that family. Okay, everything's a high profile case to that family that are the victims. So, you know, just saying, well, I work high profile cases or they're covering a high profile case, that's all well and good. But everybody I work for on cases of a death or whatever it may be, a rape, anything like that, that's their high profile case and it should be handled that way.
That's right. I agree wholeheartedly that.
Exactly.
Regardless of you know, the circumstances, that is you know, a high profile case for them.
Right.
Absolutely.
Right.
That's why we do this, right?
That's it.
Yeah.
That is it.
Yeah. Well,
this was a good show. I like having Dean and Karen on a lot. You know, this is great. This was good. Two good, interesting cases tonight. You know, and especially with that Selena Cass one, we gotta follow it. I'm gonna keep following that one online and seeing any, because
right.
you know you're not gonna see anything breaking on it. That's not gonna be your breaking news on Fox. You know, so the only way you're gonna have to follow is one of us tell somebody else, one of us what we've heard about it and what's new, or an arrest was made, or this or that was happening. So I'm gonna go to the ending now here, Tom. I think it's about time for that, right? We want to say thank you to the CrimeWire team. Our Director of Research, Kim Colton, Public Relations Team at Imagine Publicity. Our next show will be on Tuesday, October the 25th. Tune in as we continue to analyze cases and crimes that wreak havoc on families looking for answers and seeking justice.
Thank you for joining us tonight on CrimeWire. We always welcome your support and value you as our guests. If you would like your case to be featured on CrimeWire, email us at thecrimewire@gmail.com. To hear a rebroadcast of tonight's show, go to www.crimewire.blogspot.com, turn on the volume of your computer, and the show will automatically play.
Before I read the last thing, I want to send a big shout-out to Dr. Pettit from Cheshire, Connecticut. The cases are finally over, the Cheshire murder cases. Both men have been convicted, and both men have been sentenced, Stephen Hayes and Joshua Komarzewski. So we're glad that part of the nightmare is over for him. Remember, we ensure that your voices will be heard when there is nowhere else to turn. Visit our website at www.crimewiresite.com. God bless from the CrimeWire team, Vito Colucci, Jr., Denny Griffith, Tom Shanshack, Susan Murphy Milano, and Dean and Karen Beers. Okay, thank you, and God bless, and good night. Bye-bye.
Good night.
Thank you. Good night, all.
Good night.
Bye-bye.